Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. Our fifth tradition states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I am out of sorts today, sorry. Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of February the 16th, 2008. She has been continuing in service as the chairperson for the Northeast Fellowship in Clovis, as well as she is an active service board member for that group. And she's a sponsor as well. I asked her what her favorite AA motto was, and she has many, and I kind of put her on the spot, but she was able to pull out, love and tolerance of others is our code. And now, may I have the envelope, please? Woo! The one we've been waiting for this all day. The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week Award is Bonnie S. from Fresno. Thank you for letting me service.
This is awesome. My name is Bonnie. I'm a real alcoholic. I want to thank Valley Group for asking me to come share my experience, strength, and hope. I want to welcome the newcomers. I'm so glad you guys are here. I'd like to let you know that those of us who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body will be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. So I got sober at 21. Fun. My drinking career, if you will, is only about 7 years long, and it's marked by a lot of checklists that I had that I thought made me not an alcoholic. You heard about some of those ways that we like to control our drinking in the reading on chapter 3, more about alcoholism. I like to tell myself that I rarely drink in the morning, and really a White Russian doesn't count if there's milk in it. You know, that's not a real alcoholic beverage. Stuff like that. I like the parallel of you know, drinking only at home and then never having it in the house. Like, I tried both of those. Those are just polar opposites. They still don't work. Stuff like that. And I mainly told myself, if you never become like your alcoholic mother, you're not an alcoholic. If you don't exhibit any of those behaviors, you're not an alcoholic. And then I exhibited almost all of those behaviors. I introduce myself as a real alcoholic because I think there's some confusion about what that is in the room. It's not a challenge. Like, I don't think I can out-drink you necessarily or anything like that. That's described on page 20 and 21 of the big book. I am one of those crazy big book thumpers. That's where the program of recovery is. That's where I found my conception of a higher power who has kept me safe and protected for a little over 4 years. Page 20 starts off with this, what I like to call a really weird person, called a moderate drinker. And it says that they have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely. If they have good reason for it, they can take it or leave it alone. I have a friend named Danielle. She's a moderate drinker. When I was early sober, we went out to a club. I bought her a drink because I wanted to drink vicariously through her. She didn't like it, and she didn't finish it. And I was like, bitch, I paid for that. Drink it. And she didn't. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. He might die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he might find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. There are probably a lot of hard drinkers in the fellowships and rooms of AA that you go to. And then it asks me a question. What about the real alcoholic? What about you, Bonnie? You might have started off as a moderate drinker. You might or might not have become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of your drinking career, you began to lose all control of your liquor consumption once you start to drink. Yeah. I have the names of the people who I can relate to on those three descriptions. My name is written all over that little paragraph. I am a real alcoholic. I did not lose a job. I've never been to jail. I've never lost a relationship. I was starting to, but I didn't have people say, hey, you really need to get sober or we can't be friends. None of that was going on. What was happening to me is every time I drank, I had this crazy allergic reaction. The doctor's opinion calls that the phenomenon of craving. You don't have cravings for alcohol until you've had some alcohol. That's what I'd like to tell you. If you think you're having a craving, what you really are is obsessed with the idea that someday, somehow, you will control and enjoy your drinking. So I would tell myself, here's what really happened. Let's stick to the truth. I can remember the first few times I drank were just sips of wine. I come from an Italian household, so that was pretty normal. It made me feel like a big girl, nothing crazy. The first time I tried drinking hardcore, I mixed beer with Sprite, super hardcore. I had a friend over, and we were trying to be gangsta, and that is as far as we got, was one beer mixed with Sprite. It was disgusting. And that didn't really work out, and I did not drink for quite a while after that. I grew up. I was born in Fresno at 5 years old. I moved to Virginia with my mom and my grandma. We lived in a very affluent suburb, very close to Washington, D.C. My first sponsor later on was really able to concisely describe my upbringing. It is a typical alcoholic household in which I'm very isolated. I'm not really allowed to go anywhere. I'm super overprotected, but not a lot of parental attention is being paid to me. So it's real confusing. I can't have friends over a lot. I can't really tell people what's going on, but I can't leave the house. I'm not really, I'm not allowed to just sneak out whenever I want, but there's not a lot of attention being paid to me either. And it was kind of a cold upbringing. And, I lived with an alcoholic mother and a severely depressive grandmother. So that was my first, attempt at drinking. I was a pretty good kid. I can't lie. I listened to my mom. I did what she told me. I never felt like she was telling me I couldn't do something just for her fun or benefit. I always had the feeling she was pretty logical and pretty smart about herself. And if she told me not to do something, it was so I wouldn't get burned. Things changed. We moved back from Virginia when I was about 15 years old, back to Fresno. All my family's in Fresno. It's where we're originally from. So we moved back, and this shift happened. We weren't going to be living with my grandmother anymore. It was going to be the first time since I was 5 years old that my mom and I lived together. Really, when I look back, I can see it was a huge change in our dynamic, but you don't know it at the time. So I went from someone who'd never had a problem making friends. I went to this high school in Fresno called McLean High School. If you guys are familiar with Fresno, that's the high school where you can learn how to, like, make a shank and a spread. That is where I went. And it was a culture shock from a really, really different high school in Fairfax, Virginia, to a really, really different high school in Fresno, California. And all of a sudden, that dynamic where I couldn't really leave the house and I couldn't really have friends over, that changed. And I found the coolest friends ever, if you're an alcoholic, the friends who had parents that said, hey, if you're going to drink, do it at our house. In fact, we'll buy you whatever you want to drink. Just stay here and be safe. Awesome. Awesome. Yes. I would like to live with you guys forever. So we started hanging out a lot, and it was just kind of the misfit crowd. And the next time I drank, I was going to meet up with that family and those friends. We had a whole laundry list of alcohol we wanted those parents to buy. They bought it for us. It included vodka and that apple schnapps stuff, because we didn't know what we were doing. And so before I went out to meet with them, I decided to have a good dinner of fish sticks. So I had some fish sticks, nothing like processed fish before you start drinking. I drank an incredible amount of vodka, and later on in the night, up came the fish sticks mingled with vodka. And that is what happened the first time I drank the way that I wanted to, which was alcoholically, which I did not know at that time. I drank a drink, and I had to keep going. I really liked it. I liked that my friends, I could do that sigh. You know that sigh? Oh. You crack open a bottle. Cool. Now my mom's alcoholic rages aren't so bad. That house, this whole culture shock thing I'm trying to deal with. Having three friends, not so bad. It's all good. It's getting good. And So as I'm in my friend's backyard puking up vodka and fish sticks, I'm thinking, God, I'm never going to drink again. And that was my first prayer to God. I swear to God, if you can make this pain go away, I will never drink again. A couple weeks later, those friends want to hang out. Their parents are down to buy us more alcohol. And the first thought that comes to me is not, hey, you said you would never drink again. It's, okay, don't drink vodka ever again. So we drank something else. That's the obsession I'm talking about. When you tell yourself, I really don't want to do this anymore, and then you have that thought that tells you how to do it maybe a different way. And maybe if you do it this different way, things will turn out better. And they don't. And then your brain tells you, okay, don't do it that way or that way. Let's try this third way. That'll work out. And it doesn't. And you start running down this long list. When you're done with that list, you make up all new creative things on a whole new list to try. That's the obsession. If you think you're craving alcohol, you're obsessed with the idea that if you try something new, if I switch to the Hefeweizen instead of Bud, I will go ahead and be okay. That'll be fine. If I drink just red wine, white wine is for pussies anyway, drink red wine, you will be fine. You will be fine, and you are not. No, it's the obsession. And so that continued on. I graduated from high school by the skin of my teeth. That's the furthest I ever went. In my education, I did go to Fresno City College, which involves sitting in what I call the pit. I was a late bloomer. I smoked weed for the first time at like 18. You know, I thought that was I was trying to tell all my friends about it who'd been doing it for years. They're like, really, body, catch up. And so I did. And it says later on in page 21, as I continued to drink, and in the doctor's opinion, I started to form this habit that I would later on find I could not break. I could not break it, even in times I desperately wanted to. So I continue to drink. I get a job. I get pretty, I'm pretty bright, you know. I can articulate myself. I can shake your hand with a firm handshake. I can write a totally fake resume like nobody's business. You know, so I get a pretty good job. I think 18, I moved out on my own with my roommate, my friend Danielle, who never paid me back for that drink she didn't finish. I move in with her, and you know, what do? When you have your first apartment, you have a party every day. It's Tuesday, let's have an awesome party. And so we did that, and if you're having parties and you're young and you're drinking, you're not an alcoholic, you're just young. I learned that from MTV, it's called The Real World. Those guys are fine. It was before Jersey Shore. Those guys have problems. The Real World, that was cool. That was cool. And that's going on. And, you know, my friend Danielle thought she was a pirate one night and drank a lot of Captain Morgan. Spent the entire night retching. I mean, we could hear her all the way downstairs. Didn't like it. I've never really seen her drunk or drink again. Weird. Far different from my vodka fish stick story. I just started trying to find new ways. She didn't. She didn't need to do that. She was not consumed by this obsession. She didn't say the next weekend to me, hey, being a pirate is no fun, but let's be in a mariachi band and drink tequila. She didn't go there with me, you know? So I'm drinking. I'm working. I'm starting to do things like call. I'm starting to do things like wake up, cry, and call into work. My grandmother's probably died 15 times. I'm starting to get written up because I called in too many times. I'm showing up late. I'm doing a really half-assed job. It's not going well. My relationship with my mom, to backtrack a little bit, because she was an alcoholic, was always strained. But it was that weird codependent strain where I never wanted to leave her alone. I loved her a lot. I still do. So we would have horrific fights. Before I moved out, you know, when we lived together, the cops are starting to get called. We're starting to get physical with each other. We're starting to say horrific things to each other. I'm starting to tell her I wish that anyone in the world, you know, Joan Crawford would have been a better mother. You know, old reference. You know, you're horrible, I hate you. And she's in turn saying things like that to me. One of the things that, you know, I'm grateful and glad I can share my experience with, but I do it will hurt my heart forever, is being physically abusive towards my mother. It does not give it any justification or rationalization when I say that she also hurt me. I put my own hands on my mother at an older age when I knew better. I hit her and the next day had to look her in her eye, which was black. It was just an awful, awful feeling. So that's going on. Even when I move out, our dynamic is still really, really horrific. It's not going well. But she and I will not leave each other alone. You know, that's alcoholic codependency. Things happen. We both say these really deep, heartfelt I'm sorrys. We hold hands. We watch some Oprah. Things are going to get better. And then it happens the next weekend. And I had done a lot of drinking with my mom as well. And at first, that was an awesome solution. There are a lot of pictures of me in my teenage years. I have the red party cup in my hand, or I've got a beer in my hand. That seemed like a fantastic solution to dealing with my mother. It transferred into living by myself, also a fantastic solution for when you get off work. Also a fantastic solution to mix with other outside issues. Also a fantastic solution to drink at people who've pissed you off. It's becoming my solution for everything. And because my mom and I are comfortable, we are very comfortable in this weird dynamic we have, really I'm the parent and she's the child. It's been that way for quite some time. I did a really good job raising her, is what I used to tell people. And all of a sudden, in the midst of my alcoholic drinking, she does this really weird, sick, twisted thing. She got sober through Alcoholics Anonymous. And that pissed me off like no other. She left me behind. She started to reclaim this role of mother. She was doing things like not engaging with me. When I would try to fling things in her face that she had done to me and nail myself up on the cross right next to sweet baby Jesus, it wasn't happening. She'd be like, I'm going to a meeting. Like, and to me at first, I'm seeing her as like this weird Stepford mom. You know, she's like, I'm going to a meeting. And like in this weird serene voice, and I'm screaming on my knees, flinging my own poop at her, you know, I'm trying everything I can, and she's just like, I love you, but I have to detach. And I'm like, go die, burn in hell and die. And I'm sure that these AA people are going to knock on the door any day with like a Bible, and they're going to want to read out of the Bible with me, and they're going to be wearing like white and black or some weird Scientology thing. And none of that happens. You know, she doesn't try to shove any of that down my throat. I continue to drink, and little do I know that as she's creating, making connections, working the steps with a sponsor, and reading the big book, she's starting to ask questions about me. And I only found this out a couple years ago. And I think about that. She's starting to ask people, hey, I don't think my daughter's okay. Here's what's going on. I think she's fucking crazy. I don't know what's going on. Here's what she did. I don't think my daughter's okay. And for the first time, I think, in her life, she's able to tell people the truth. She's able to tell people what's going on behind closed doors. And she's scared for me. And all of a sudden, out of this haze of a lot of drinking that she's been doing, she becomes this mom who really cares, who's really warm, and who really wants to know what's going on with her insane daughter. And, you know, we don't like to pronounce anyone as an alcoholic, so they would just say, you know, read the big book. Try to talk to her about your experience. And she really didn't do that at first because I'm still flinging my own poop at her anytime she comes around. So, and I have to say, that really happens in a lot of families. If you are a parent, if you are a father or a mother, and you have children who are able to know what's going on, who've seen you drink, and then you get sober, they'd like to know why their love could not fix you. They'd like to know why now, when it seems like it's too late. They'd like to know what alien has taken their parent's body. And they'd like to test you. And they like to throw things in your face that you might have forgotten because you had the luxury of alcohol. I did that to my mom. I judged her. I was angry. And I had alcohol to fuel that for a long time. And she had to have had something solid going on. And today I know that something solid is the God of her own understanding. to be able to hear the venomous stuff that was coming out of me and not drink and not use that as an excuse to drink. I know that the words of our children, from other people's experience that they've shared with me, are some of the most painful things that we have to sit through and listen to in sobriety. And that's way before an amends comes. I know that. That's about day 10. You know what I mean? You get the luxury of having like 12 days sober, and then little Timmy wants to know why mommy is now sober, you know, and it's no fun. So that's going on. I'm really mad at her. And my drinking increased in a really dangerous way. I'm starting to drink with people who are not safe. I'm starting to drink in places that are not safe. You know, I'm drinking with some friends one time, and a friend says, I feel like calling the cops on myself. It's not a good sign. You know what I mean? When, like, you're just ready for the cops to intervene on you. You know, it's getting ugly. I'm starting to face some consequences. And I'm waking up every day more and more ashamed of who I am, of what I've become, of what I ever was, and feeling like I have no right to be here. I already had those feelings, and every single day those feelings are increasing. The waking up and crying is happening every morning. The waking up and being angry at God for allowing me to wake up is happening every morning. I'd wake up and I'd be so pissed off that I woke up. Oh my God, I thought I drank enough. Or I thought that God realized I was such a piece of shit that he was going to go ahead and take me in my sleep. Have you not realized this? Because I've known it for a long time, sir God. You know, kill me now. That feeling is really happening. And it's happening on a more and more frequent basis. It's happening every day. And so when you feel like that, imagine what kind of choices you're making. And I know a lot of you guys can. We don't have to imagine. We've been there. And so I have this boyfriend, hostage, whatever works for you. He prefers boyfriend. And we're drinking together, and you know, the illusion is like we're having a couple. I'm telling classy jokes that are right out of the New Yorker magazine. We're making sweet love. And then we're like rolling on into a meadow of flowers. And that's not what's happening. I'm drinking. I'm beating him up. I'm saying horrific things to him. I'm seeing other people on the side. And I'm creating that cycle over and over again. So my last drink was on Valentine's Day, because I'm classy and romantic like that. Boyfriend hostage took me out to dinner. I ordered one glass of red wine. Circle back to that white wine thing, red wine only. The second I took a sip of that red wine, I thought to myself, you are going to have to drink more, and it's going to have to be a little bit stronger than this. And that idea after I drink of having to drink more had been happening for a long time. But that was the first time I really heard that voice very clearly, and it emphasized the word have to. You have no choice. You are going to have to drink more after you have this. And so I did what I had to do. After we finished our classy dinner, I bought a fifth of whiskey, drank that, remember drinking a lot more, and then I remember nothing. I remember picking a fight with boyfriend hostage, opening my mouth and knowing that I was going to say some vile stuff, and that's it. Then the lights go out. I woke up the next morning fully clothed, which had started happening. I had no idea what I'd said. I look at him, and it is as if I stabbed him repeatedly. It is as if I had killed his entire family. He still won't tell me. I still don't know what I said to him. But it was probably some of the worst stuff I could have ever thought of. I know he had dead relatives. I probably brought them up. Anything that he'd ever shared to me in a moment of love or intimacy, I'd probably brought up in a really condescending, mean way. And I have to look at that face. So I barfed in his trash can. I called my mom and asked her to help me find my car for probably the third or fourth time. Because as I'm so angry at her, I'm also secretly quite attracted to what she's got going on. I've been with her to a couple AA meetings, still drinking. I'm choking back tears. I'm just sitting there holding my breath, choking back tears because I can relate, but I don't want to admit that. I have not found my own truth yet. So she helps me find my car, which was like 30 steps away. I don't know why I couldn't find it, but I could not. I really had to like take that day to sober up before I could drive that car. I was still drunk. Later that evening, I got it home, and the next day she took me to my first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, where I said, my name is Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I remember shaking. I was shaking. I wanted to unzip my skin and jump out. I wanted to die. I was so ashamed. And all I had was this voice saying, no, you're not really an alcoholic. As soon as I said that, the voice in my head was like, shit, take that back. You just told on yourself. Now you really can't drink the way you want to in front of you. You can't say, hey, Mom, you're going out to Livingstone's. Nope, done. You just said, I'm Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic. What were you thinking? What a joke. You're 21 years old, and you're in a room full of Civil War veterans. Stop it. Stop it. You know? And I know for the first time, I'm sitting there, I'm shaking, and I know that that voice in my head is lying to me. And I'm thinking, how long have you been lying to me? I thought you were so right. And you've been lying to me this whole time? Because here are people who've done what I couldn't do. There's some guy over there trying to eat his own ear, and he's got more time than you. What is going on? You know, I'm seeing what is called the truth. And, you know, the doctor's opinion talks about the alcoholic life seeming the only normal one. And I thought my life was normal. I thought the dynamic in my family was normal. I thought the way that I treated my mom and those around me was normal. And then I saw people who would say, I'm an alcoholic, and then exhibit some of the most normal behavior I've ever seen. You know, and that's not consistent with alcoholics or with those of us in AA, but it's quite hopeful. And that's what I felt, was a lot of hope. And I had felt no hope for a long time. The lights had been out for me for a long time. So pretty quick, there was this lady named Donna who was sharing at a meeting. I felt a real connection to her, and I asked her to sponsor me. I had no idea what that meant. And I told her as much. I had never before said, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what to do. If you asked me a question before and I had no idea what the answer was, I would just off the cuff it because, you know, I'll just make it sound good. And so for the first time ever, I said, I don't know what to do. What do I do next? And she said, read the doctor's opinion and underline all the words you can't define. Look them up in this concordance, define them, and then call me. And I was like, done. I'm not stupid. I know every word in the world. I will tell you a definition. Then I, you know, actually read it, and there was stuff like altruism. Nope, lost on me. I have no idea what you're talking about. What the hell is a doggerel? That's in Bill's story, but, you know, I like to overachieve. Abnormal, chronic, phenomenon of craving. So I'm starting to see a weird pattern of things that I'm underlining, and I'm finding the definition, and that was pretty awesome. And little did I know, I started on my first step. You know, my first sponsor was real good in not telling me what was coming next. We just did it. And if I had questions, I asked questions, and she answered them. We took the steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It calls itself a basic text. I used it like a textbook. And it also told me that no further authentication was necessary. We did not use the 12 and 12. We used the program of recovery, which is in the Big Book. That saved my life. We got to this whole idea of a spiritual solution for the spiritual malady. And I was like, yes, no, nope, I'm sorry. I've been baptized. My problem is with alcohol. Can you help me with that, crazy lady, and stop talking about God? And she did not. She continued on with her crazy God talk. And so did the Big Book. And we got to this thing called We Agnostics. And page 52 has something called the Bedevilment. And right before you get to that page, it says, leaving aside the drink question. So we're starting to get real deep. I'm not even allowed to consider the problem surrounding drinking. Now I have to look at these things called the bedevilment. And she told me to turn them into questions. Are we having trouble with personal relationships? Boyfriend hostage. Can we control our emotional natures? Flinging poo, you know, verbal poo at my own mother. Are we a prey to misery and depression? I wish I was dead right now. Can we make a living? Do we have a feeling of uselessness? Are we full of fear? Are we unhappy? Can we seem to be of real help to other people? Wow. I wasn't all right. I wasn't doing okay. And then if I drank, it was even worse. Wow. And you'll come across these bedevilments, you'll see them in yourself, and you'll see them in other people. And when you can answer yes and no, depending on what the question is to a lot of these questions, no matter how much time you have, you're suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I'm here to tell you what untreated alcoholism looks like. Although I worked the steps with that sponsor, I did not really carry the message. I did not really work with newcomers. And I started to slide back. I started to slide back all the way back into these bedevilments to the point where at 2 years and 10 months sober on the day I tried to kill myself sober. I was put on a 5150. I was taken in an ambulance to Clovis Community Hospital. I have no medical insurance, so they slapped me on a gurney in the middle of the hallway and let me sit there. And I was like, why won't this person not leave the foot of my bed? I would like to leave this place now. And I was not allowed to leave. I could not leave. And I met with a counselor who could decide whether or not to lift my 5150. And he said, are you sober? And I said, yeah. That's asshole. I am sober. And, you know, I'm in an assless gown, right, shaking. And I just tried to end my own life. And he's like, really? How did you get sober? And I said, through AA. And he's like, that is totally working for you right now. Wow. Wow. Good job. And that was a spiritual bottom for me. I had been through a physical bottom with alcohol, a real emotional bottom, but I had not had a spiritual, really, really humbling bottom. It is quite humbling to try to kill yourself when you have some sober time under your belt. I recently heard a lady say, don't drink, don't use, and don't try to end your own life. Don't do it. Please don't try to end your own life. I know what it's like to be sitting in meetings, talking about God, and still wanting to die. I know that feeling. I know what that's like. I know what untreated alcoholism looks like and feels like. I have that experience. I'm stepping all over people. I'm not making amends. I could care less if you give me more change at the store. I'm keeping it. You should have done your job better. I cannot live an honest life. I still can't look you in the eye. I still want to die. And I feel like I can't tell anyone that. If you can't take someone aside and say in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, hey, I want to die, there's nowhere else. And it feels hopeless. And I know what that feels like. So I got another sponsor. We took the steps even more hardcore out of the big book. I started to get honest. I started to really tell him what was going on. And I could breathe. I could breathe like when I used to open up a beer bottle and go, and lick it and rub it on my face. You know? That's what I used to do with beer. That's what I do with my higher power now. You know, he's tangible. I'm holding on to him. I'm kissing his feet. I'm begging him, you know, day by day to help get me through. And when a newcomer walks in the room, I'm starting to look them in the eye and say, hi, I am so glad you're here. I stopped using the rooms as my new bar and telling you how my day went. I stopped thinking that only meetings could keep me sober. I stopped looking for triggers. Life is a trigger. I started living my life. A much greater demonstration of our principles lies outside of these rooms and our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. That's what the big book tells us. I had to start demonstrating these principles I was using outside of the rooms. It's so easy to come in here and sound good. It's awesome to be asked to speak. It's easy to come up here and sound awesome. It's really hard to go out there. It's really hard to have a job where you don't like anyone and you're the only one making amends, you know, and you're like, now you go. I've made amends to you. Now your turn. Go. And they won't, you know, and you can't say anything. It's really hard to speak disrespectfully to your mother and have to look her in the eye and make amends. It's really hard to maintain and nurture a relationship with a best friend. It really is, because I'm selfish. I want to think about myself. I want to talk about myself. I want to look at myself in the mirror or not, you know, just depending. I want to, you know, shut up. Can we talk about Bonnie? You know, I don't want to do all the other stuff I'm commanded to do, but when I do, I'm free. When I sit down with a newcomer or anyone that has asked me to take them through the steps and we crack open this big book and I start asking them to take the same direction I've taken, because I'm showing them and telling them through my own experience how we got out from under. And I'm meeting with them in the fellowship of the Spirit. That is the most freeing thing I've ever done in my life. When I sit in a room and I'm called on and I say, my name is Bonnie, I'm an alcoholic, that is the most free I can ever be. When I tell you my story, when I tell you the experience that I've had drinking and it not working out, that is the most freeing thing I can do for myself. When I can tell you that I know what shame feels like, I know what shame drinking and I know what shame sober feels like, and that it's okay, and that we can talk about it, that's the most freeing thing I can do for myself and for another person. And when they say thank you, and I say, don't thank me, but thank God, let's pray. Wow. When I don't take credit for it, wow. When we can get on our knees and do the third step prayer, wow. Relieve me of the bondage of self so I can better do your will. I'd like to be relieved of the bondage of self so I can just go create more havoc. You know, I'd like to just get more creative with it. No, so I can better do your will. Take away my difficulties. Take away Bonnie. Fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, self-pity. Take that stuff away. Please. Please, higher power. Please, God. Please, whatever you want to. Please, creator. Please, you know, guiding light. Whatever you want to call him. When I see love and tolerance in the rooms, I feel free. When I hear people talk about a different higher power, I feel free. And I thought that if I could drink and get away with it, I would feel free. And that is some of the worst bondage ever, to try to create new ways of drinking and new creative drinking habits so that I could possibly get this feeling that I got the first couple times and I can feel free. And I'm scraping myself raw so that I can feel that. And I'm killing myself so I can feel that. And I'm not feeling it. In fact, I'm feeling more and more and more imprisoned by myself and by my insane thoughts and mind. And to do something completely opposite, not of my own willpower, but of something way bigger and better than me. That one is God. Most of us call him God. If you don't want to call him God ever, that's cool. I really respect that. You know, I am an active service board member at Northeast Fellowship. If you're ever in Fresno, please come see us. We have a lot of meetings and we could use some good recovery. I have friends. I have people I tell the truth to. I live my life. I plan for my life. I take not drinking on a 24-hour basis sometimes. But after a while, it's cool to plan. It's cool to make some plans. I'm going to be a mom. I mostly need to say that so you guys don't think I'm fat. Okay? 7 months pregnant. I might be a little chubby, but I'm also going to be a mom. And, you know, I can tell you that my own mom probably feels awesome for a lot of 24 hours that we've had of me not seeing her drunk. And I'm real excited for my daughter to not see her mom drunk and to not see her mom's drunk behavior. I can have that opportunity today, provided I stay close to him and perform his work well. And his work is loving the new person and saying, hey, welcome. Don't keep coming back. That might kill you. Please stay. Please stay. Give yourself a chance. Give this idea of God a chance. Give anything that sounds like it's bigger and better than you, electricity, light, anything, a chance. Because you are suffering from a spiritual malady. You are. You are very sick spiritually. You're probably also pretty sick physically if you've been drinking alcoholically like a lot of us were. You can be restored from that as well. Thank you guys for listening to me. Thank you again to the new people for being here. I'm glad you're in a really safe place. I'm glad that your higher power, that God has delivered you here. I sure do hope you stay. I don't come to meetings to be reminded. I don't come to meetings to get grateful. that's really not necessary for me. When I wake up and I'm not next to some guy whose name I don't know or I haven't barfed on my pillow, that's when I'm grateful. Every morning. When I do my morning meditation in the same bathtub I tried to kill myself in, I'm pretty grateful. I don't need to hear about your horrible life to get grateful. I have that. I'm super grateful for the message I have to give to the new person. I'm super grateful for those who came before me who had a message to give me. When I was shaking, I wanted to die, unzip my skin, and jump out of it. When I hated myself, and when other people who had lots and lots of time and a program of recovery could share the same thing and then tell me how they got out from under. And I just want to leave you with a few words from the great Dr. William Silkworth. He's like the Dr. Drew of my generation. And he says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Please, get a big book. Get a sponsor. It'll save your life. Someone to help you through the 12 steps. You don't have to call them sponsor. Maybe don't. Their ego might not need it. You know what I mean? 12-step guide, you know? Help me out. Help me out. It's all right. Please stay. Thank you.